Hey everybody, this is Richard Deitch. Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media about their job and their process. My guest this week is the ESPN broadcaster and writer, Jim Trotter. He joined ESPN in May of 2014. You see him on NFL Insiders, SportsCenter, Sunday NFL Countdown, hear him on ESPN Radio, and other forums. Jim, absolutely one of the top guys when it comes to NFL analysis. He's incredibly thoughtful, worked with me for many years as a senior writer at Sports Illustrated, and prior to that was a longtime writer for the San Diego Union-Tribune, covered the Chargers for more than a decade, wrote a book on Junior Seau. Very few people, I think, as connected to the Chargers and their future as Jim Trotter. And again, just on a personal note, one of the best colleagues that I ever worked with at Sports Illustrated. As part of this conversation, which I really think you're going to enjoy, we talk about the Hall of Fame voting. Jim Trotter is one of the 48 voters for the Pro Football Hall of Fame, yet that body is not very transparent with the public in the way that they want transparency from coaches, players, and owners.
It means a lot to these organizations to have a player go into the Hall of Fame, and I do believe there's enough pettiness out there that you could face some sort of backlash if it were found out that you didn't vote for their guy.
We'll also talk about access journalism and the perils of that, how Jim believes the NFL as a whole is covered, what he has learned morphing from writing to a primary television role, what it was like for him to get laid off by Sports Illustrated and to see others in the business have significant interest for him. And of course, we will talk about what is going on with the Chargers and where they might end up. It's an hour conversation. If you're an NFL fan or beyond, I think you're really going to enjoy it. Let's go to Jim Trotter of ESPN. All right, we bring in Jim Trotter from beautiful San Diego, California, my former Sports Illustrated colleague, now, of course, at ESPN. Jim Trotter, welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, Jim, I want to start off with there's a lot to get to between the NFL, your varied places that you've worked, from the San Diego Union-Tribune to Sports Illustrated to ESPN now. But you are very – anyone who follows you on Twitter knows that you are very honest when it comes to the NFL. So I want to just – I want to start with this general question, understanding that it's very hard to generalize because the sport is such a team-by-team coverage, so to speak, a regional coverage sport. That said – overall, how would you evaluate the coverage of the NFL? And that's an intentionally open-ended question.
Sure. I think for too often or for too long and too often, I think folks have been reticent to really be honest about the power brokers in the NFL, the people who ultimately make the decisions. And I'm not talking about coaches and management. I'm talking about owners and league executives. And so for me, it's more of I try and go where maybe others aren't as likely to go. And for me, that's why I've tried to at times focus on being honest about the folks who do make decisions. And I think it's so easy for fans to target players, and whether it's contracts, whether it's off-field issues, those sorts of things. But ultimately, I think there's a lot of hypocrisy in the NFL. And so for me, one of the things I've tried to do is just focus on exposing some of that and just being honest about it. And I've had these conversations with the league where I've said, you know, it's funny because people think that I don't like Roger Goodell. And I've said to them, I don't know Roger Goodell. I would never say I don't like him. I said, what I don't like is hypocrisy and people who want to insult your intelligence. And I think that too often, I think that's what the league does with the public. And I think if the league just owned up to certain things, we might not like it, but we'd at least respect the honesty. So that's the way that I approach it. The thing, though, now is that there are so many eyeballs on the NFL and there are so many people covering it that, you know, it's so popular that anything it does or anything that anyone does now, it's a feeding frenzy. And I don't know that that's necessarily a good thing, because now everything is about, you know, hot takes and give me an immediate reaction. And I think the context and nuance gets lost a lot of times, and situations aren't necessarily as black and white as we want to make them out to be.
Jim, how would you evaluate the kind of access a reporter like yourself at the national level can get to Roger Goodell?
It's not good. That's why I laughed, again, talking about, you know, insulting people's intelligence. When he gets up at his State of the League address and says that he's available to the media almost daily, I can't tell you how many requests I've put in for Roger and am not allowed to interview him. And I've heard that from other colleagues. So, no, there's not a lot. Really, the only time you get him is at the State of the League address or at the league meetings or something along those lines. But obviously, if it's a particularly sensitive topic, you're not going to get him at all. And whether it's domestic violence, whether it's the drug policy, whether or not it's his relationship with, you know, the union and the Players Association, those sorts of things, if you place a call to him, or at least I can speak personally, I won't speak for anyone else, you don't get a call back on.
Jim, do you have any theories as to why the public sort of tends to wrap themselves around issues of players or coaches and not league owners? Is it I'm sort of just doing my own hypothesis here. Is it a case of, one, not having the access to the owners so we don't hear as much for them? Two, because you could obviously identify with the players because you see them? Or three, is it something even more deeper that it's sort of an economics issue and that I'm hypothesizing, I don't even know if I want to sort of say it's a race-based issue, but it's always striking to me, and I see this a lot on social media, how quickly people will sort of tag and get on players, but they rarely sort of really go after owners unless ownership in a certain city just really proves to be, I mean, over the top horrible.
No, I think there is truth to that, and I think it's multi-layered. I think you're absolutely right. On the one hand, the access to owners can be difficult and can be tricky. The other thing is the things with owners, for instance, their books. We never get to see their books. We never get to see economically how they run their franchises because they're private entities, except for, obviously, the Packers. And so with a player, everything is out front. You know his contract. You know the length of it. You know the amount of it. You know when it was signed. You know when it's due to expire. So all of those things we know about. And then there are times when the players are disciplined. Obviously, we know about that. And if owners are disciplined at times, we don't always know about it. And that's why I say, again, going back to the league's position, when you have a personal conduct policy and you tell us beforehand that owners and team executives are going to be held to a higher standard, excuse me, and in black and white, you know, in that policy, it says you are subject to discipline for all these various things, including fraud. And yet we've had two ownership groups who have been involved with fraud cases. One was convicted, and that's the Will family, and one paid a $92 million fine to settle the fraud case, and that's Jimmy Haslam with Cleveland.
Right.
And yet neither of those owners were publicly disciplined, and yet players have been disciplined for, I mean, the most minute of things. So how is that? How can you hold yourself up and say that you're being consistent and you're applying the policy even-handedly when we have things like that that go on? So I think it's easy for fans to get after players because all the access to the players is so readily available, but I also think it goes beyond that. I think there's a group of fans that says it's like, you know, the movie Gladiator. You know, they just want their entertainment. So the question becomes, are you not entertained? And anyone that they feel that takes away from that entertainment, they're going to focus their ire on. I do think that there's a cultural issue, if you want to say a racial issue as well, where I think at times there has been sort of a plantation mentality where, you know, the players are the hired hand, the hired help, or I shouldn't even say the hired help, you know, they are the owners feel they own them, for lack of a better word. And I think that at times players are treated that way. And that's one reason that me personally, I'm so excited to see some of these players be more outspoken about certain issues and to now start to see themselves as businessmen instead of just players and to use leverage when they have it and all these sorts of things to try and level out that playing field.
That's well said, and obviously, I shouldn't say obviously, but I happen to agree with you 100%. It it sort of has always been a boggling thing to me to see oftentimes just knee-jerk attacks on players. But the, you know, Jim, like the sort of the best example of it is, I don't know how you feel about this, and it's, I understand it's a small thing, but it's a, it's something with sort of meaning. Owners always get the honorific, Jim, Mr. Mara, right? Like, you know, Mr. Kraft. It, and that, it's not always, Jerry Jones might be the one guy who gets Jerry. But it's always striking to me that the owners sort of get that Mr. Honorific. You've never heard even Mr. Brady or Mr. Manning. And it does speak to something either cultural, Jim, or something else in that television is also very guilty of this, that we put owners up on some kind of absurd honorific or pedestal when very often these owners are far worse in their business life than anything any of these players have ever done.
No, but I'll say this to you. I think some of that, too, is generational because I've used Mr. when it comes to an owner, and it's not because out of any reverence necessarily. It's because of the way I was raised, and if someone's older than me, then you always approach them or address them as Mr. If I have an owner who's more my age, then I can speak personally. I can say I use first names. So, I think there may be some of what you're going on, but I also think some of that it may be cultural from the standpoint of just how you were raised. Yeah. I was always raised that if you're addressing someone who's older than you, and by older I don't mean a couple of years, but then you say Mr. And until you develop a relationship where you get to that point where you're told it's okay to say otherwise, you don't. So I think there may be some of what you play, but I don't think in every case it's there's something nefarious there, if you will.
Right. All right. Well, clearly, Jim, you were raised better than me. So that's.
I don't know about that.
All right. I want to ask you about access journalism. And one of the tags that, I mean, people who we both like and respect and have worked with, whether it's Peter King or Adam Schefter or people like Jay Glazer, et cetera, there are many, especially from independent outlets, Deadspins, et cetera, who really are very critical of the access journalism in the NFL, with the implication that reporters have traded independence for access, or reporters become sort of more part of the league as opposed to really independent of the league. I don't consider you an access journalist at all when it comes to the NFL. But if you can, stepping back, how do you look at those who are very much the transactional brokers in the NFL, and are they working on a slippery slope between independence and being a little too close to their subjects?
I'll tell you, it's a great question, but I think it goes even deeper to that. It's not just about the reporters. It's about the business in general. I remember when I came into journalism, and that was many moons ago, and this was back during a time where we didn't have the internet, and you know, cell phones were essentially in their infancy, where they weren't small, but they were, you know, bigger than some phone books. But so, again, I'm saying it's a long time ago, but there were things that went on where I think there was more of a focus on conflict of interest. And, you know, you were told in no way could you ever accept, you know, any financial remuneration from someone you're covering or a team you're covering or a league you're covering. And right away, you know, it could cost you your job and those sorts of things. And in some ways you were almost taught not to get too close for fear of being there being a perceived conflict of interest, if you will. I don't know that that's so much the case today. I think today it's all about, in many cases, and this is not, I'm not speaking to Adam or Peter or Jay or any of them, I'm just speaking in general, but there is a focus on how many clicks can you get, how many eyeballs can you get on something. And at times I feel it's less about how you do it than just can you do it. And that's scary to me, because I think it's very, very dangerous. And, you know, we're seeing the battles play out publicly now in terms of our, you know, the White House and you know, the treatment of the media and all of the focus now on journalism and how it's done and whatnot. So I don't know that it's – I think it's a bigger issue than just a few individuals. I think we have to decide, you know, in this business, what we're comfortable with, what the tenets are, what the foundations are, what the principles are that we're not willing to compromise on. And I think that we've, at least from when I got into the business were getting farther and farther away from the things that I was taught when I came in.
Jim, that's interesting. I wonder sort of how you feel about, do you feel that, or at least I should say I feel this, and then we'll see how you feel. What's interesting about the accessed journalist is that, and I'm not saying this pejoratively, I'm saying this as I believe it is sort of a matter of fact or statement of fact. You can be financially rewarded and employed for a long period of time if you are that. The transactional journalism in sports has really become a valuable tool, it seems like, for a lot of places. So isn't there incentive? Whether it's right or wrong, would you agree that there's incentive for people to become this? Because whether it's Sports Illustrated or ESPN or other employers, they seem to want that.
Oh, without a doubt. That's part of what I'm saying, is that we're moving towards that, because it's all about, can you bring in the eyeballs? Can you get the clicks? And, you know, I'm speaking in general here, which can be dangerous at times, but I'm just trying to be as honest as I can with you. I definitely think that we're moving in that direction. You know, it says something, and I've had this conversation with people in the business, that, for instance, you can do a tremendous investigative piece. You can do a piece that you know, is Pulitzer worthy, and they can put that up on a website next to a list of, say, the top 10 hottest wives of NFL players. And that list is going to get a lot more clicks by a large margin in most cases than this great investigative piece.
Right.
So what does that say? If the thing now about journalism, at least when I came in, I remember it wasn't people didn't talk about the money or the business of journalism in terms of economically. It was more about the public service that you were providing. Now it's a bottom line business, and we're seeing, you know, people losing their jobs because and people coming into the business in terms of purchasing media outlets for the sake of making money on it. And so, do you criticize them for that? And because the response I always get, well, we're just giving the public what it wants. If we have a great investigative piece and nobody's clicking on that, but we have this list over here that folks are clicking on at a 10-to-1 ratio, why wouldn't we put that up? Because that helps our bottom line. So I hear those things, but that's why I say to you, yes, we all are culpable in this. I think the public, I think us in the business, it's nothing wrong with wanting to make money. As a journalist, I don't think it has to be mutually exclusive that you have to be poor and destitute to be in this business. But at the same time, I do, as you say, I think we're on a slippery slope, because I think we're getting away from some of the tenets of what the business is.
I want to ask you about your role at ESPN. You spent a long time in your career as a traditional print writer covering the Chargers for the Tribune. You then went to Sports Illustrated, where as a senior writer, you did some more long-form stuff. Even though, obviously, you filed for the website, you were able to get at least a little more time doing quote-unquote feature writing or some more long-form writing. Now you're doing a lot of television work, coming in, offering your opinion, maybe having 90 seconds to provide something or being part of a conversation. That's a lot of changes, Jim, over the course of of one career. Is there... do you prefer what you're doing now? Could obviously be much more lucrative, but do you prefer what you're doing now to what you did 15 years ago as a beat reporter for the Chargers?
You know, Richard, truthfully, I don't think it matters if I prefer it. The bottom line in today's business is you better be able to adapt, because it's changing so quickly. And if you want, I'll never forget the conversation when I was at SI, and we had a meeting in New York, and we were told that they wanted us to you know, get involved with social media. They wanted us to get involved with Twitter. And I was not on Twitter at the time, and I truly had no interest in being on it. And then I sat there and I listened to them. I said, I could do one of two things. I can sit here and be a dinosaur and say I'm not interested in that and probably be unemployed in the not-too-distant future and not be relevant. Or I can adjust with the times and say, you know what, this is the way things are going now, and if you want to be relevant, and if you want to be employed, you better take part in it. So that's, I would answer your question that way and saying it really doesn't matter which I prefer, because I think now you've got to be able to be versatile, and you make yourself more marketable by doing all of these things. And that's not to say that each transition, didn't include headaches or there weren't adjustments. I'm still adjusting. I still feel like that I have a long way to go in terms of television in particular, because for me, you know, you have what I call information guys in the NFL, and they're there to break news and all those sorts of things. And the one thing I've tried to be more than that, particularly at ESPN, where we have, you know, Adam Schefter and Chris Mortensen and these guys who do a great job at that, is to be able to provide context. I think sometimes that's what gets lost in today's age of hot takes and immediate opinions is context. Can you provide some grist to the story? And that's what I hope to excel at, and that's what I've tried to be good at. I'm not looking to necessarily break a story. I'm not shying away from it, but that's not where I feel necessarily my strength is. My strength, I hope, is that I can provide context and some sort of, you know, if it's a historical balance or some background on not necessarily what happened, but why it happened.
Jim, how do you prepare for your, and please go as in-depth as you can, how do you prepare for your spots on either NFL Insiders or another ESPN show? What is the process from whenever you start preparing to the time you go on the air?
Well, it's interesting. It depends on what the topic is. I mean, there are some topics that I'm more familiar with, I'm stronger on, or I've written or reported it, so I know it off the top of my head, and therefore it doesn't require much more research. But then there are some teams that clearly I'm not as strong on. And so what happens is we come in and we have a production meeting, let's say for Insiders, each day. And it's usually at 9 or 9:30, and it's a half-hour meeting, and we will go over their potential topics for the show. And so, for instance, let's say we're talking about the Tennessee Titans, who I don't have a lot of contact with, that sort of thing. If there's something we want to address there, and I'm not really strong on it at that point, then I'm going to get on the phone when we leave the meeting, and I'm going to start making calls to people. I'm going to start reading more to see if I can find out information that helps me understand what it is we're going to talk about, or to be able to provide some context as to what's going on. And then typically you'll have sources at various teams or people who are familiar with teams, and you'll make calls to them to see if you can get information on that. And you're doing that in between, at least I am, Sports Center hits or an outside the line hit or something along those lines. So that's how it is for me. You know, a lot of times, for instance, when the Chargers were moving, it didn't require any research for me because I was already up to speed on it and had been reporting on it. But then when we flip over to a different team, now I've got to go do a little more work and make more calls and try and get more information so that hopefully I can bring something to the show that's different from what someone else has.
Jim, one of the things that a lot of writers who now do a lot of TV tell me is that one of the biggest adjustments is to learn how to talk in broad strokes isn't the right word, but sort of it's how to tell a whatever the top line or most important thing is ultimately what you have to get out, as opposed to when you're a writer and you have 3,000 words, details and nuance. Those are all, you know, in additional reporting, those are all things you could get in. For you, what has that adjustment been like to go from a forum where you have, you know, many, many words, potentially an indefinite amount of words, depending on the web, to you have a finite amount of time to get an opinion in about a specific topic?
No, it's tough. And the funny thing for me is sometimes I feel like, you know, you have some folks on TV who they're so glib and they can just roll with it. And they don't have any problem with it. Well, for me, sometimes I felt initially early on, I was too short because I didn't want to open up, you know, I didn't want to go down a certain road unless I could provide that context or that nuance. And so I would just give sort of the headline of it without getting into great detail. Or when we're on and I'll say, let's say a coach's name or a coordinator's name, and I just take it that anyone who's watching the show is going to know that this person is the offensive coordinator or the defensive coordinator. So I don't give his title. And, you know, so, you know, a producer a couple of times had to tell me, hey, can you just kind of identify the person before you do it? So there are all these little things with TV that, you know, again, I was saying that there are adjustments and you have to learn it. What I've since learned or what I hope I'm getting better at is that instead of just giving the headline and being quick, not wanting to go over, that you can choose the most important and provide a little more detail without being long-winded about it. And I think that, that producers appreciate that because I think brevity, in my opinion, if you as concise as you can be, is better for the viewer or on radio, the listener, as opposed to touching on a lot of topics or a lot of issues within one topic and never really explaining any of them in any sort of detail. So I'm going to tell you this. For me, TV, the hardest part, this is what I struggled with early. One was looking at a camera. And people think, and I'm one of those people who thought it was so easy. I have so much respect for people who do TV and do it well because I have found it's very difficult to look at this inanimate object and somehow have be comfortable with it. And I'll tell you a story, and I don't think he'll mind that I tell it because it comes from a good place, and he was trying to help me, and I truly appreciate it. So I'm not in any way making fun of him or you know, in any way trying to put him in a bad light. But the first time, it was the first or second time for ESPN I had to do a stand-up, and it was early in the morning, and it was in Seattle. It was before a Seahawks 49er game. And I did the stand-up, and again, I'm stiff because I'm not, it's new to me. I'm looking at a camera, not a person. All these different variables are going through your head where, you know, you want to sound glib and you want to sound, you know, like you're giving good information and those sorts of things. And so I was stiff, and I knew it. And after we finished the hit, my phone rings, and it's a number at the time I didn't recognize, so I didn't answer it. And when we got a break, I went back and listened to the voicemail, and it was Sal Palantonio calling. So I called him back, and I said, "Hey, Sal, what's going on?" And he asked me this question, and he said, I'll give you the short of it, because I don't want to give the long of it, but he basically said, "You have to treat that camera as if it's your wife or your girlfriend, and in essence, you have to make love to that camera, you know." And I'm sitting here listening to it, and I'm going, "What?" And then as the more I thought about it, I understood what he was saying. You know, you can't look at it as a camera. You have to look at it as a person, and you have to connect with it. And by connecting with that camera, you connect with the audience. And obviously, Sal is so good at it, and I still have a long way to go with that. But I appreciated what he was telling me because, you know, for folks who have done this for a long time, you know, I always want to pick their brain about how do you do it? You know, how did you become so good at it? What does it take to be good at it? Because it's new for me. But that's also what makes it fun, is that it's a challenge. And some people at ESPN understand that you're new to it, and they're willing to give you time and hopefully see you get better. And then you have others, I think, who make a quick judgment on you and say, you know, I'm not sure he's ever going to get better, and he is what he is, and that's okay too. But the goal is to always strive to be better. And so when folks like Sal or others offer that those sorts of opinions or suggestions, you know, I take them to heart and I appreciate it because ultimately at the end of the day, you want the product to be good.
That's an interesting story. One can argue, and listen, I certainly respect Sal Palantonio's career. One can argue he's a little bit of a ham on camera, but it's worked for him, I think, because you remember his takes. This does lead, Jim, to something interesting to me. When you are on a beat, writing-wise, you are competing against, maybe it's a little different when you were in San Diego because there weren't 50 other papers or something like that, but
correct.
You know, your competition are the people around you. In New York, if you cover the Jets or the Giants, there's 9 other people who are traveling with you. That's your competition. In your position at ESPN, do you ever feel that you're competing against other people, either one for airtime or maybe more importantly, two, to sort of show the bosses that you are the person they should bring on when these issues of relevance come? Because that would be the interesting thing to me at ESPN. You got a lot of people who are there. They're paid oftentimes a lot of money. There's a lot of egos involved, but there's not often a ton of airtime, especially if you have multiple people on a set. So do you look at this in terms of competition at all, or is that not how you approach it?
No, it's a great question. It's one that I grappled with before I went to ESPN or even before I went to SI. And here's the way I look at it. At the end of the day, I say we are a team. We are a company. We are a team. So whatever I can do to help the team, I don't need the credit. As long as my bosses understand what I'm doing, I'm comfortable with that. But you're right. There is this sort of pressure, internal pressure, if you will, where you feel like, you know, you need to see your name on the bottom of the scroll, or, you know, you need to have your name on out on one of the blogs saying that you broke such and such a story. There is that pressure. But I refuse to succumb to that, truly, Richard. I'll give you, for instance, with the Charger story, and I had found out about this story, that it was possibly coming down days before it happened. And in order to get it confirmed, you know, we all as reporters at times, we will make, judgments on whether or not to go with it right away, or you enter into an embargo agreement sometimes where someone will confirm a story for you, but they will say, you know, you can't go with this until you have to agree that you won't report this until I've been able to notify my staff or whoever. And that's kind of what happened with the Chargers relocation story. I had found out beforehand that they were going to move, but in order to get it confirmed and to nail it, I had agreed that I would not report it until Dean Spanos, the club chairman, had notified his staff, which was going to be the next morning. Well, funny thing is, that night at about 7:30 p.m. Pacific, I get a call from Adam Schefter, and he says, you know, I just got the weirdest text, and it said that the Chargers are going to move tomorrow, going to announce tomorrow that they're moving. And so right away in my mind, the question became, this is a huge story. You know, do I just play dumb and try and save this for myself the next morning, or do I, confirm to him that, yeah, this is what's going down? And so what I said to Adam is, and I'm being as honest as I can be, I said, look, I'm in an awkward position. And I said, I'm going to be as truthful with you as I can. I said, you found this out on your own, but it is true. And I said, but I am embargoed on this until tomorrow. And I said, I've given my word that I would not report this until Dean Spanos told, his staff what was going on. I said, but here's what we can do. I said, I'm going to call my source and say that you are aware of it, that you have found out about it. It did not come from me. And I said, I will give you the number. You can call them, and you can get whatever you need from your story in terms of confirmation or denial or whatever from them. And you do what you feel you need to do. And he did, and he broke the story, and it was great. But I felt like there were some people who know the story say, man, how did you feel? You got basically beaten on your own story. And I say, no, I don't feel like I got beaten on my own story. I feel like ESPN got the story, which is, at the end of the day, is all that really matters.
Jim, I appreciate you sharing that story. Would you have felt the same way, or would you have acted in the same manner had it been a reporter that didn't have either the standing or reputation of Schefter at ESPN?
I think so, because I have. There have been other stories where we have 32 NFL Nation reporters, and there are some, obviously, I'm closer to than others because we've had relationships over the years, but they will call me on something and say, can you help with this, or I can't get this person, can you help? And then, of course, you help them, and then they break a story or whatever, and in a small way, you feel good about it. Nobody ever knows you're involved with it or what role you played in it. But again, I go back to this. We're supposed to be a team. And as a team, you hope that you all work together for the good of the company and not for selfish interests.
Jim, I want to segue to the Hall of Fame, if we could, because you are a voting member of that. Every single year, there is there's a lot of debate. There's debate, obviously, around all the Hall of Fames, baseball as well. But the NFL Hall of Fame particularly just seems to drive people mad. For whatever reason.
And the Hall of Fame loves it.
Yeah, no kidding. So I'm right. 48 people vote?
Correct. We're up to 48 now.
Okay, so you're one of the 48. Maybe the two most, this podcast, obviously a lot of process, but I want to ask you sort of a content question here just because I think people would be interested. Two of the most notable decisions this year in terms of not getting in were Terrell Owens and Paul Tagliabue. Could you offer just sort of any kind of sort of oversight as to why they did not get in and what you think the future for them may or may not be heading forward?
Sure. I'll start with Terrell Owens because there's been so much focus on him. I think everything you've read has been spot on about it. I think the big issue in the room was that he was perceived as a divisive player who teams, even in his prime, couldn't wait to get rid of. And that's the argument that, critics made against him. I'm not one of those people who believed any of that. I voted for him. I will vote for him again. I have no problem with that. I believe that we have people in the Hall of Fame who have done a lot of bad things, and yet they're in the Hall of Fame. So Terrell Owens, I believe if you look at the context of why some of those teams let him go, I think he deserves to go in. It wasn't about him being divisive as a teammate, so to speak. There were financial issues and a guy who wanted to get paid. But I'll say this. In my 11 years on the committee, I will say that that's the most uncomfortable I've ever been in a room listening to the debate on Terrell Owens. And I went to one of the hall officials during the break, and I told him that. I said, I've never felt this uncomfortable about a guy being debated in this room, because it did. It felt personal to me. It may not have been. I'm not saying it was personal. I'm saying it felt personal to me, and that was very disturbing to me. Will he get in? I believe he will get in at some point, but that's what's so ridiculous to me, to be frank, Richard, because don't tell me that you're going to make him wait, you know, 2, 3 years, 5 years, whatever it is, simply because you felt he was a bad teammate, but he'll get in, you'll vote for him at some point. If you're not willing to vote for him now, you shouldn't be willing to vote for him in 5 years. You know, he should be judged simply on his merits, in my opinion. And I'm not one of those people who believe in sending messages and making guy wait a year or two. Either he is or he isn't. Either he's one of the five most deserving or he's not. And that's the way it should be. The other guy was Paul Tagliabue. And now I can speak to this because I'm one of the people that spoke out against him. So we're not supposed to repeat what's said in the room by someone, and I won't repeat what anyone else says, but I will tell you what I said because I don't have any problem with it. I thought, you know, Sal Palantonio presented him. I thought he did a great job. I thought there had been a lot of people who spoke up on Paul's behalf. But here were the issues I had as I laid them out. Number one, prior to Paul being debated, Jerry Jones was debated. And some of the things we said about Jerry Jones as to why he should get in the Hall of Fame is that he was a visionary. He helped take the league to new levels in terms of revenue streams and those sorts of things. That when the league wanted to give rebates to the television networks, when the networks were crying poverty, Jerry was one of the owners who said, no, we're not going to do it. And in fact, it ended up in the next round of contract negotiations producing a record deal. The other thing, you know, when Jerry came in, he went against the league with his Pepsi sponsorship deal. The league went after him, even wanted to take him to court. Jerry ended up prevailing, and look what that did for the league in terms of revenue. So when Paul's name came up and people started talking about the growth of the league in terms of revenue and those sorts of things, I said, wait a minute, you can't have it both ways. You can't say that Jerry Jones was responsible for all these things and we're going to put him in the Hall of Fame because of that. And the key guy he was fighting most of the way on those things was Paul Tagliabue. So how do we turn around and give him credit for that? I said, that's one. I said, two, we've heard about labor peace. Paul never had a work stoppage on his watch. And I said, but the work stoppage that we did have was the direct result of the last labor agreement that he negotiated. And I said, it was a shitty deal. And I said, that's not my word. That is the word of owners who opted out of that deal at the first chance because they felt it was such a bad deal and they felt like they had not been informed about what was in it. I said, so do we give him credit for labor peace when the last deal that he did resulted in the first work stoppage in 3 decades? And I said, the third and probably most important issue for me was concussions. And I said, look, it's no secret Junior Seau was a friend of mine. And I said, it's very difficult for me to see Paul's bust in the hall alongside Junior Seau's. And I said, look, I will acknowledge that the science today that we know, we did not know back during Paul's time. I will acknowledge that. But I will also argue that when the science was presented to the league either tried to poo-poo it or flat-out contradict it. And I said, for instance, Paul Tagliabue appointed Elliot Pelman, a rheumatologist, as the head of the brain committee. Well, when Dr. Amalu's study came out, what happened? Pelman went to the medical journal and tried to have that study retracted from it, which is the ultimate slap in the face of a scientist. And my point is, if you say that the science, you didn't know the science, well, here's the science being presented to you, and what did you do with it? You said in a letter to Dr. Malu how it was faulty, it was fictitious, it was sloppy, it was all these other things, instead of saying, wait a minute, maybe there's something here that we need to look at and present it to the players. And it wasn't presented to the players. And lastly, I'll say this. I said, I've heard a lot of support for Paul in this room and different people outside the room speaking up on his behalf. Lastly, who's speaking up for those who can't speak for themselves because they're dead? And I said, let me let some family members speak up on behalf of some of these individuals. And I phoned some of the families who had lost loved ones, in part, potentially, because of CTE. And they allowed me to read their letters in that room about why they felt Paul Tagliabue should not be in the Hall of Fame. So if you want to know why some people were against him, they can speak for themselves. Those are the reasons that I voted against him.
That's well said, and I could not agree with you more. I'm never going to vote for any Pro Football Hall of Famer, but Paul Tagliabue would never get my vote for the exact reasons you elaborated. I do want to ask you, Jim, one thing to going back to Terrell Owens, and this may be an issue with Randy Moss. How do you view the relationship of players to media in relation to the Hall of Fame voting? So that's part one. Part two, how do you think the room views it?
Let me say this. Again, these are my opinions, which don't make them facts. They're just the way that I view it. I believe that there is something to be said for players who were nice to the media. I do believe it helps when there is a close vote at times that some guys get in that maybe, I'm not saying they're not deserving, but should have gotten in at a later point or got in faster than maybe they should have. So that's first and foremost. You know, I'm fascinated, and that's the word that I use. I am fascinated to see what we are going to do next year when Randy Moss is in the room. Because the one thing you cannot say about Terrell Owens is that he took plays off or he took games off or that he didn't give his all every time that he was on the field. So when you start talking about integrity of the game and all of these issues, and you have a supreme talent in Randy Moss who told you publicly, I play when I want to play, and you can go back to certain seasons and trace it and see he must not have wanted to play. Are you going to put that guy in right away? I'm fascinated to see how we're going to deal with that. All these folks who use reasons to keep Terrell Owens out. And look, let me say this, and I don't know how graphic I can be on your podcast, but here's my thing when you start talking about quote-unquote bad teammates. We have a person in the Hall of Fame who, when he would get upset at teammates at times, and I'm being as literal as I can here, once went out and shit in a teammate's car, okay, who pissed on a teammate's car when he was mad at him. We have people in the Hall of Fame who knew that they had a trainer who happened to be gay and would lay on the training table while getting his ankle tape and pleasure himself until he was erect, and he's in the Hall of Fame. But you're telling me now that those sorts of things we'll look past, but not in the case of Terrell Owens, we're not going to put him in the Hall of Fame because some teams decided they wanted to get rid of him when he was still in his prime. Are you kidding me? I just have a hard time with this whole Terrell Owens argument. This was one of the greatest players of his era. This was a guy who was an impact guy that you had to prepare for every time you went out on the field. And now as we start talking about impact on the field and achievement, you know, in the game, we keep pushing the boundaries. We're going from now, when I first got on the committee, I heard about between the white lines. Well, now the white lines also extend beyond that to the sideline. And now it extends beyond that to the locker room. Well, at what point do we get to public or what you did in society? You know, at what point is that included in this discussion? Because it seems to me like we're pushing it farther and farther out and we're getting farther and farther away from what we're really supposed to be voting on, and that's who were the greatest players of their day in terms of the NFL game.
Jim, we could do an entire podcast on everything you just said there because I have my own sort of feelings about that. Why are the votes for the NFL Hall of Fame not made public? Or why? I guess in a way I could understand protecting the sanctity of the discussions. Like, you don't want that filmed. I kind of get that. What I don't get is why the ballots are not made public. It's a business that asks for transparency from players and coaches and owners and personnel, yet that's not transparent. So why?
I asked that same question, and here's what I was told. It's essentially to protect the voter in this way. If, for instance, let's say you're presenting John Elway to go in the Hall of Fame, and you and what happens is the person from each city that a player played in is the one who presents him. So if you're a beat writer in Denver, you're on the Hall of Fame committee, you're going to present John Elway. Well, let's say you're up to present John Elway, but you don't think he was a Hall of Fame player, and obviously no one would ever think that. But I'm just using an example. Say you didn't believe that he was a Hall of Fame player. And so you speak out or you know, during the debate and the discussion and say that, hey, I know what his numbers are and this, that, and the other, but here's why I don't think he was a Hall of Fame player. And let's say that he doesn't get in. And then now you got to go back to your city and your team and say, and they find out that you didn't push for their guy and you didn't vote for their guy, and now there could be some sort of retribution. That's what the Hall has told me they're trying to protect voters from. But what I have said and what I believe is that we can't ask for transparency and not give it. So I specifically asked the Hall, are you telling us that we are forbidden from disclosing our votes, or are you recommending that we not disclose our votes? And I was told that we are recommending that you not disclose your votes. So every year, anyone who asks, or if I'm writing about it, I say who I voted for. And I don't have any problem with that. And if I can't stand the heat, then I should get off the committee. That's just how I feel. But I understand the Hall's point of view, because it can put a voter in a tough spot when there are only 48 votes. And if you covered a guy and you didn't believe that he was a Hall of Famer and you speak out, and now you go back to your club, because it means a lot to these teams and it means a lot to these organizations to have a player go into the Hall of Fame. And I do believe there's enough pettiness out there that you could face some sort of backlash if it were found out that you didn't vote for their guy. So not only do we not disclose our votes to the public, but in the room, we don't disclose our votes. It's a silent vote. So none of us have any idea how the other person voted unless that person chooses to say so.
I cannot disagree with that enough in terms of the transparency part. It's just, you know, as someone who cares and loves journalism, it's just so hypocritical to, like, to ask players to talk to us, to ask players and others to be honest, yet there's this protectionism for those in the room. And I would actually want to know who's making the presentation as well. Like, and this is no disrespect to Sal Palantonio, but I want to know who is making that presentation to Paul for Paul Tagliabue, because that's going to shape my opinion on them as a reporter, given that I think Paul Tagliabue looked the other way for years on players' safety. So I appreciate you being honest about that, and you've probably been as honest about that as anybody who I've ever heard who's in that room. But it's very, Jim, just as someone who cares about this stuff, it's very frustrating. I realize there's more important issues and those covering immigration in this country and conflict regions. This is sort of meaningless compared to that. But within the context of sports, it's really frustrating, Jim. I'm not going to lie. Those votes should be public, because it's literally what we ask people to do every day.
I don't disagree with you, and I've made that argument, and it's up to each individual. If an individual wants to disclose his votes or her votes, he or she can. If they choose not to, they don't have to. The fact that it's a silent vote in there is interesting to me. So, because what happens, we have what are called the silent assassins, and that's people that lead you to believe they're going one direction, then all of a sudden your person doesn't get in the Hall of Fame, and you're like, wait a minute, man, because sometimes you do try and count votes and say, do I have enough to get so-and-so in the Hall of Fame? You know, if it only takes 10 votes to block it, are there 10, do I know of 10 votes that are against my guy? And so it goes on. But, you know, and so when you think you have it and your guy doesn't get in, and you say, man, who were the silent assassins? The folks who said to me, may have said to me or made it appear they supported the guy, and then they didn't. It's an interesting room, and it's an interesting dynamic. And And I couldn't agree with you more. I believe in full transparency, and I believe if we're going to ask for it, we should give it.
Jim, one last one. How does one become? I know that I think I'm right about this. I know there's like a representative from each team, so sure. that would be 32.
For each city.
Each city. Okay. So how do the additional people become voters, and what is the how does it work with the turnover?
Well, it's what happens is the Hall of Fame approaches you and asks you if you would be interested in being on the committee. And they have representatives from each city who are on the committee. And then they have, or when I got on, the way it worked, there were 10 at-large votes. And obviously that's been increased since then. And they just approach you and ask you if you're interested. Now, traditionally, the hope is that you will have covered the league for some time so that you will have seen some of these players and these people and you have an understanding of the historical aspect of the league and those sorts of things. But the reality is, too, it's coming down to will that person be at the Super Bowl every year the day before the game to vote? Because, you know, for the Hall of Fame, it doesn't do them any good to say, I want so-and-so from this city, and then knowing that that paper, because of an economic issue, isn't going to send that person to the Super Bowl, he or she won't be there to vote. So they also want to make sure that these individuals will be there the Saturday before the game to vote.
All right, I want to finish up with a couple of sort of go around the board here on different topics. When you left Sports Illustrated, and I've been very public about this, you were one of my favorite colleagues. I think it was an absolute disgrace that you are not there anymore. That's my personal opinion.
That.
Hopefully,
I appreciate that.
Yeah, my bosses will hear this, but whatever. It's not like I haven't put that on Twitter and elsewhere, so it still pisses me off. That said, you were one of the fortunate ones in that. When people learned that you were no longer at Sports Illustrated, Fox Sports, Bleacher Report, ESPN very quickly reached out to you. What was that process like for you, Jim, in terms of, you know, your world gets shifted pretty dramatically. You're not at the place you were at for 7 years. And then all of a sudden, there's a group of people who want your services when you had not, I imagine, in 7, 10 plus years, been in a position where there's, you know, it's almost like being a free agent, basically, I guess, as an athlete. All of a sudden you realize, oh my God, one, there's a world out there beyond Sports Illustrated, and two, there are a lot of people who want me.
Yeah, I'm going to be as honest with you on this as I can, as painful as it may be. That was the first time I'd ever been laid off in my life, and it was interesting how it went down because only a little over a month earlier, I'd been in New York for the Super Bowl, and I remember there was an email that came out and said, you know, there was going to be another round of layoffs and cutbacks and those sorts of things. But my immediate supervisor said, you know, he didn't believe it applied to me. So I really didn't give it a lot of thought. So I'm literally, if I remember right, it's a Monday, and I'm driving my wife actually to the dentist. And as we literally pull up to the place, my phone rings you know, it's one of the head guys at SI. And I'm thinking he's calling because we're going to talk about a story or something like that. And he just says, hey, I got some bad news and we're going to have to let you go. And it's not a performance thing. It's more of a, you know, we're cutting back and in all likelihood there's going to be an IPO and we've got to get lean and all that sort of thing. And so I really didn't know how to handle it. I had never been fired before. And the irony of the whole situation was, whenever I would talk to high school or college classes, I would say, if you're going to go into this business, you better have a thick skin. And I would say to them, you know, if you can't handle being laid off, it's not the business for you. And then that day that I'm going to speak at San Diego State, what happens? I get laid off. So it was sort of a surreal experience, and I didn't really know how to handle it. I didn't know what to do, and I sat in the car while my wife was inside and was trying to figure out what to do. And so the first thing I did is I called a few people in the business that I know and trust. And I said, hey, you know, I just got laid off. If you know of anything that's out there, can you let me know? And I don't know if these people would like me using their names or not, but I'll use them anyway, just because I respect them so much. You know, I called Mike Freeman and I told him. Then I made a call over to ESPN to Rob King, who I didn't know well. I'd only met, didn't have a real relationship with, but I just said, hey, if you know of anything. And then I made one other call to another friend. And And then there was a fourth call, and I said to this person who's not in the journalism industry, I said, what should I do? And I said, this is going to get out. Do I get ahead of it, or do I wait? And this person said to me, no, I would wait a few days before saying anything. And the more I thought about it, the more I just thought about the way journalism works today. And I said, nothing stays quiet forever or for very long. And so I just went on Twitter and put it out there and said, I want to control the message. And I said, I've been laid off. I think the way I did it, I tried to be a little funny. Free agency was coming up, and I said something to the effect of, hey, add another name to the free agent list. You know, I just got laid off. So, and within 3 or 4 hours, there were a few places that did call and say, we'd like to interview you, and or, you know, we at least have some interest. We heard what happened. So I felt better, only from the standpoint that that I felt there would be something out there. Because I'll tell you, your first thought, and again, I'm speaking only about me. My first thought, it wasn't about me. It's your family.
Right.
It's like, you know, what do you do now? You're responsible for other individuals. And so, you know, you don't want them to worry and be scared and all those sorts of things. But as a man, you know, I was raised, and I know we're in these PC times where we talk about different roles of whether there are true roles for men or women, but I was raised that a man is supposed to be the head of the household and take care of his family and all those things. And so my first thought was, how do I take care of my family now? So that was those were my concerns right off the bat. And then once I realized that it was going to be okay, I was in the process of finishing up a book on Junior Seau, so I had something to keep me busy. And within, I think it was 7 to 10 days, I kind of knew where I was going, and so it was all good. But it was a surreal experience, because what happens is that you learn a lot about the place that you worked or the people you worked with, because after the fact, then I find out I had never gotten a negative job performance review, those sorts of things. But then you find out that they had been keeping tabs on all of the employees. They were being graded, so to speak, about their areas of strength or areas of weakness and those sorts of things. And no one had ever told me this. And so after the fact, when you're dealing with the guild, the guild about the severance package and all these things, and these reviews start to come up that you knew nothing about, and you're saying, well, wait a minute, that's not the way that was. And you never even had an opportunity to present your side or even to say to them, is there anything I can do to keep my job? And that was weird to me. And that was sort of disheartening to me about my situation, is that after the fact, I heard some things, and it was unfortunate, because I remember Peter King called me shortly after it happened. He said, did you have any wind of this? And I said, no. And he said, well, it's interesting. I was in this weekend and your name never came up. And I said, Peter, I really don't know what to tell you then. It kind of is what it is. But, you know, that's the sad thing about this business today, is that there are so many people that I respect and talented people who are on the street. And I feel for them, because it's not about performance or a lack of performance, it's just now about the bottom line. And that's what's so unfortunate to me. And I feel for those people. So when you go through it, you have a different perspective on when you read about someone else. And I can only speak for myself, but I really can empathize with those individuals, because I think not only about them, but I think about their families. And I think those are things that get lost in the process.
Yeah, that's well said. I mean, I hate to sort of look at it as a fatalist, but I feel like we're all going to get it at a certain point. But I was obviously incredibly happy to see just how quickly you not only got another job, but I honestly think you're in just a much better and stronger place. And as I've said, it's ESPN's gain. And, you know, whether it's Rob King or whoever else, they ended up making an excellent hire. All right, I want to finish up with this, Jim, because I told you I'll keep you for an hour and we'll get you out of here. Is you have sort of intimate knowledge of San Diego in relation to the football team and the stadium and all the issues there. And when I put out that you were going to be my guest, there were a number of people, maybe they were San Diego people, who just wanted to know how you view that franchise and its relationship to San Diego and where it's heading now. It's for those of us who live on the East and sort of just read it from afar, Jim, I'm not going to lie, it's a great town, and obviously they love their football, but it's just, it's always sort of strange. Like, you sort of think that the Chargers ownership, they don't really want to be there. They kind of always want a better deal. I'm saying this out of ignorance. It's just more of just me reading the tea leaves. You live there. How do you view it? Because it's, you know, going back to the AFL days, it's such a historic franchise, yet it's about to go.
Yeah, no, the way I view it is this. This is the age, or this is the way the NFL does business. You either play by its rules, or it takes its football and it moves on. It goes someplace else. It goes home to a different home. I do believe that Dean Spanos wanted to stay in San Diego. I truly believe that, but he wanted to stay on his terms. And the way that the NFL has set it up now is that either you are going to capitulate or you're going to pay a price for it. Look, you know, St. Louis was willing to come up, as if you believe what's been reported, with at that time a significant amount of money to keep the Rams in St. Louis. But it was pretty apparent that the owner wanted to go to L.A., and so he did. In San Diego, Dean Spanos basically said, look, it is going to cost X number of dollars, public dollars, for the team to stay. And the city wasn't willing and the county weren't willing to put up those dollars without a public vote, which he knew was never going to pass, or he believed was never going to pass. But, you know, it's indicative of something more than just San Diego. Mark Cuban had, I thought, a very insightful comment where he said of the NFL, you know, pigs get fed, hogs get slaughtered. And at some point you have to wonder when, in an attempt to squeeze every dollar that it can out of every revenue stream that it can, when the NFL is going to face a backlash. And in California, municipalities have been unwilling, for the most part, to put public dollars toward these private ventures, sports ventures. So when you look up in the Bay Area, the Giants ballpark was built with private dollars. The Warriors' new arena is going to be built. It's going to be privately financed. When you look at the Rams stadium in L.A., it's going to be privately financed. California is one of those states that is now standing up to the NFL for the most part and saying, or to pro sports teams and saying, we are not going to subsidize billionaires. And I think ultimately you may start to see more states or cities do that as well. And I think the NFL has to be very careful here, because that leverage game at some point is going to backfire. And it backfired in San Diego, to where now a city that has been so supportive of a franchise for 50 plus years no longer has that franchise. And that's unfortunate, because I'm a firm believer. The Chargers belong in San Diego. The Raiders belong in Oakland. I believe these AFL franchises in particular, which, you know, that they're so linked with the cities that they started out in. And I realize the Chargers started in L.A. for 1 year, but have been in San Diego for 50 plus. I just believe that those teams should stay where they are. And I believe the league should do everything it can to keep those teams in these cities. And me personally, I don't believe that the NFL did everything it could to help this team stay in San Diego. It's one thing to say, we're going to give you an extra $100 million after you got, backstabbed at the meetings in Houston on the vote for LA. But it's another thing to say, I'm going to put boots on the ground and really try and make this work to bring these two parties together, meaning the team and the city, where there was so much mistrust that had developed over the years, and try and make this work. And I don't believe that the league did that, and definitely not to my satisfaction, to make it work.
Jim Trotter joined ESPN in May of 2014, and he can be seen on NFL Insiders, SportsCenter, Sunday NFL Countdown, and a variety of other ESPN programs. You sometimes hear him on ESPN Radio as well. He was a senior writer at Sports Illustrated, I think, for 7 years, covered the Chargers for more than a decade at the San Diego Union-Tribune. In my money, absolutely just one of the best guys in the profession. Honest, thoughtful, can't recommend him enough in terms of a Twitter follow, and somebody I wanted to interview on this podcast the second it started a year ago. Jim, man, personally, I miss you at Sports Illustrated, and but I'm very happy for your success. I will always follow as well as watch you and read you, And I can't thank you enough for being on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
No, I appreciate you having me, Richard. Always a pleasure, man.
All right, back in the studio, my thanks to Jim Trotter for giving us a little over an hour. I probably would have gone much longer with him, but Peter King has the studio right now. Lou Pellegrino and I have shifted to the alternate studio. Peter King, of course, the big dog at SI. He gets you gotta make room for Peter King. He's the franchise, so I gladly give up the studio to him. But now we are back. I'll bring Lou on. Lou, you've dealt with Jim Trotter before, being a producer for many radio shows. He's always a thoughtful guy, and I actually just, if you get him in a long form like this, he's really, really good. You know, he's he thinks about his answers. He's not a sort of a rat-a-tat kind of like give me a soundbite guy. That's why I think a podcast forum for him is really interesting. And again, we could have done an entire podcast on the NFL Hall of Fame, because to go behind the scenes in that body is really, really interesting. And he amplified what was going on with Terrell Owens and Paul Tagliabue. That was pretty fascinating to me.
Well, you know, he touched on it in the podcast earlier. You talk about the way journalism used to be. Journalists would cover guys, and that would be it. They were the eyes and ears for the fan. They took you inside the locker room. There was no friends. You may have been friendly, you may have been cordial, but now we're in this day and age where you try to become buddies and pal up to the guys. Why? Because you want to be able to get quotes. You want them to come to you with exclusives. You want to know, hey, I'm signing with a new team, or hey, I'm demanding a trade, and you get all this inside information. And you're looking at the Hall of Fame that I think there are a lot of people, and Jim touched on this, that don't like Terrell Owens because of the way he carried himself or conducted himself in the locker room towards teammates. But, you know, Jim makes a good point. There are a lot of bad individuals who have done bad things in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and they're making it personal against T.O. maybe because they didn't like him or they tried to buddy up to him and it just wasn't happening.
Well, the one thing that's interesting to me are the writers for whatever sport who actually come out and say, yeah, how they treated us impacts my vote. Well, I don't particularly love that. I respect the honesty. I think what bothers me is when we don't ever learn that there are personal issues between media person X and player who is considered Y. Like, I think as a human being, if somebody says, listen, this guy was a jerk and this is going to impact my vote, you may not like it, but at least you respect the honesty.
Sure.
What sucks about the NFL Hall of Fame is that there's just nothing transparent. We never learn anything about the whys, and that is frustrating, I think, to a fan who really, I think, should be afforded, at a minimum, who voted for who.
Right. I also see a very unique similarity in why referees are not interviewed or allowed to be interviewed after games, because I know there are a lot of fans out there that, yes, I want to know your reasoning for making that call. Right. And if your reasoning comes down and is told to me and I can say, all right, I can live with that, instead of carrying around this anger and carrying around this hatred for a referee or an umpire because they basically...
Which is silly in itself.
Right, of course. Right. But there are... I'm putting myself in the shoes of the everyday fan.
Right.
But, you know, umpires, referees, they are not held accountable by the media by answering questions post-game. There's a report that's given and what have you. But, you know, look at the Hall of Fame voting. Yeah, you're right. I would love to know, hey, I did not vote for him. Why not? Because this reason. Yeah. Then at least I have a reason rather than you just saying, I'm not voting.
Trotter's point, though, about the interesting thing that he said was the point about your the local team. Like, I understand where he's coming from. It would be a tricky situation if you did not vote for sort of the hometown hero and you're covering that team. That creates some...
Right.
But so what?
Like, it's like a New England reporter not voting for Tom Brady.
Right, and that person would be sort of killed for it, but that's the job. I mean, you sort of like, I feel like... you know, you state your reasons as to why that's... It's not really going to happen in New England, of course. Right. Tom Brady will be up first ballot. But yeah, I know what you're saying. All right, Lou,
yes.
If you want to be part of this, we'll try a little something different. I'm not going to make this too long, but I may start on this this fine podcast that we're doing, just sort of giving some thoughts on some very quick roundtable-ish kind of thoughts if some big stories broke this week. We will save the longer conversation for Trina O'Rand, and if Jim Miller joins us. But two quick things.
Are we going to title this? Are we going to billboard it? What are
we're not
do?
Billboarding it. Because literally it's going to be less than 5 minutes.
It's not like Deitch Thoughts or something?
Not
like
really.
That,
no. Well, I'm just going to ramble for a couple seconds. You should weigh in anytime you want. I know how closely you follow this stuff. But
sure.
At Fox Sports 1, very big stories this week in terms of the contracts of Jay Onwright and Dan O'Toole were not renewed. That ends a three-year run for those guys, initially brought on to be almost the one of the faces of Fox Sports 1. Mm-hmm. They were essentially the best parallels, maybe Dan Patrick and Keith Olbermann of Canada, came over to the States, were charged with sort of being the faces of a SportsCenter equivalent, and that show blew up very quickly. Ratings never were there. The show really didn't know exactly what it was. It was kind of a discombobulated mess. And 3 years after this, these two guys came over, they are no longer at Fox Sports 1. I really appreciated and enjoyed what they did. I think they were very smart and sardonic and clever, sort of from the David Letterman school. And it's a shame that Fox Sports 1 never figured out sort of what to do with them. In particular, once Fox Sports 1 shifted its philosophy to sort of all opinion all the time, let's bring the Skip Baylesses of the world in and, you know, scream about LeBron James, you know, short of lighting our junk on fire, let's do anything we can to get ratings. And Jay Onwright and Dan O'Toole would not be part of that world. The other big news, Lou, and then I'll get to you here, is Katie Nolan's Garbage Time was not renewed as well. Fox has said that they're going to have figure out what to do with Katie Nolan. I don't doubt that at all. Her contract's not up for a while. I think they recognize that she's a talent. You don't have many women in the business who are opinionists under the age of 35, so that makes her a pretty valuable resource. So I think they'll try to figure out what to do with her. I don't know if they're going to be successful at it. But, Lou, that's a lot of changes for one of ESPN's biggest competitors. Well, they are in name. They are not in ratings, but they are in name. And the important thing about Fox, Lou, that you just have to know is, News Corp has so much money in the billions that you could lose the ratings game for a long time if you have Rupert Murdoch bankrolling you. I don't know if you're ever going to catch ESPN, but you can stay in the game for a long time. And they've made money just in terms of their sports rights, et cetera. But those are, you know, in terms of talent, that was pretty big news. No more Onwright, no Tool. And then Katie Nolan, even though the ratings of Garbage Time have not been great, but she's got a lot. She's got a lot of popularity in social media. So to me, it's just interesting to me. Are they going to figure out long term what to do with her, and can they keep her long term? I don't know if those answers we know right now.
Yeah, I don't. I don't. Honestly, I think she's going to outgrow Fox Sports 1. I think
Comedy Central. You see her more of an ESPN.
You know what? I don't know if ESPN would go that route, but I could definitely see her doing something. Yeah, Comedy Central. You know, some sort of like Sports on the Edge type of thing,
right?
Where, you know, look, I watch Fox Sports 1 pretty much only for live play-by-play. And Onwright and O'Toole, like, I've known them because of the amount of Canadian media that I've known, because that's where they came from. They came from Canada, right?
Right.
And they just, I don't know if they just meshed with what Americans were looking for. I mean, granted, I thought they were very entertaining, and the few times that I did catch them, they did keep my interest. It wasn't like, oh, look at these two guys thinking that they're so funny, and they're not. I enjoyed them. I thought it was a different breath of fresh air type of show. And for whatever reason, see, people are creatures of habit. It's just like local New York sports radio. You could put 35 different new sports stations on every radio station in New York, California, wherever. If you grew up listening to KNBR in California, that's what you're going to listen to in San Francisco.
Francesa in New York.
You're going to listen to Francesa in New York. Why? Because people are creatures of habit. No matter how much you either like them or even get to the point of disliking them because, oh, they're just blowhards. They only say, oh, the top fans speak. Oh, you still go and listen. So that's why in ESPN radio here in New York, they're just making a dent, if that.
Barely.
But that's what you have to try to do. You can't take in this case, you can't take the Death Star out with one lucky shot.
Right.
You have to try to make a couple of dents in it. And I think if Fox Sports 1 actually just did that and stayed the course, maybe the ball would start rolling. But, you know.
Well, the course wasn't working for them prior, but the course isn't working now.
No, I know.
The problem for them is that you can't, in my opinion, program a network from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. on just debate and arguments, because eventually your viewers are going to get tired of it, mm-hmm. and you're fighting for a very small slice of the same pie. I'll make one prediction about Katie Nolan. I do think eventually she will leave Fox Sports 1. I could see her doing either HBO or more than that, some kind of digital player, Netflix type, Hulu type, where she goes and tries to create something.
I just felt bad for her in the sense.
Don't feel
that
bad for her. I mean, she's making a lot of money.
Not feel bad. No. I know.
Feel
that.
Bad for the
what
school
I,
teacher
what I
gets
mean
laid
is,
off.
What I mean was the uncertainty of when her show was going to
I
air.
Agree. Yeah, totally. I mean,
the fact that the show was shuttled and shuffled right. all over the
yeah,
place where it was on 11:30 right. one night, then it was on at 1:30 after a live play-by-play game.
I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No,
you got no chance of getting viewership when your show is being shuttled around on a network that's already not getting a lot of viewers.
Right.
Yeah, you got no shot. All right, the other quick thing. I'm already tired, by the way, from this podcast. I need a nap.
Jimmy T did most of the talking. How are you tired?
Jimmy D did most of the
you
talking.
You want to see the sound file? I'll show you your
show
speaking,
me that sound file.
Your speaking parts, and I'll show you Jimmy T's speaking
parts. Well, that's
intentional.
Parts. This podcast uh-huh. is about the guests, not about me.
Right, of course.
It was very disappointing to see Bleacher Report, which is an outlet with quality writers, talented behind-the-scenes people, delete editorial content at the behest of Turner Sports after Mark Cuban complained about a tweet about, and a very dumb tweet, by the way, admittedly, about Dirk Nowitzki. As I wrote, I understand and respect Cuban sticking up for his guy. The tweet was pretty hack. But, Lou, it's very dangerous, in my opinion, when you start letting sports owners dictate content.
Mm-hmm.
And Turner Sports is a rights holder partner with the NBA. They own Bleacher Report. And very dangerous when owners can start dictating content because this tweet is meaningless. It's just dumb.
Right.
But if a NBA owner starts calling up and saying, hey, I don't want you guys to do this investigation on drugs. I don't want you to do this investigation on medical. That's where it gets really, really scary. Mm-hmm. And I wish that Turner's executives had sort of like said, listen, Mark, we respect where you're coming from. We understand. We're not taking the tweet down, even though it was stupid, because there's a larger principle at play here. We control our editorial content. You don't. And that was pretty disappointing because I feel like Cuban totally bullied them into doing this. The irony, of course, is Cuban has been one of the most outspoken people about Donald Trump's bullying. And in this case, Mark Cuban totally bullied the press.
Yeah. You know, I look at the situation and I'm right there with you because who's to say Jim Dolan
exactly.
is it the next guy to make the
well,
phone
Jim
call?
Well, Jim Dolan, I guarantee, has called up. Oh, I'm positive about this. Trust me on this. He has called up media outlets when he believes the coverage of him has not been positive
favorable.
Or favorable. Yeah, I mean, you know, I guarantee he may not be calling the Daily News up anymore because the coverage is always negative. But if it's not Dolan, it is emissaries of, you know, this
right.
is what a lot of public relations or high,
right.
high level communications people do. Their job is oftentimes they're the ones who make the call to the publications to try to put some pressure on them.
Do you think it was just a knee jerk reaction by Bleacher Report? Like, well, we don't want to get any of the owners mad, so let's just do this. Or do you think this was something that was, you know, talked about internally and this was the ultimate decision? Because this almost sounds like a knee jerk reaction. This almost sounds like somebody who may have
totally knee
jerk.
Yeah,
right, what I mean is
he looked at the thing and he got pissed off.
But what I'm saying is it might not have been somebody in the highest of high power positions at Bleacher Report and says, you know what, before this blows up, let's just take it down. Let's just take it down right away.
Oh, I know what you're saying. I don't think
like somewhere in the chain of command that
I
never
you.
Reached the top.
Yeah,
somebody
no,
just like said, I'm making the call.
I understand
this.
What you're talking about. No, I don't think so because Cuban emailed David Levy,
got
who's
it.
The president of Turner, and I would think that it filtered down from the
uh-huh.
top of Turner. I do not believe it was some like mid-level editor who's like, ah, Mark's right. Let's just take it down. Again, Cuban was not wrong. The tweet sucked. It's just the larger principle. Once you start letting outside people dictate mm-hmm. your content, you're dead. It'd be like if, I don't even know, what if ESPN, if Trotter's boss, after the Trotter interview airs, calls us and says, hey, I want you to take this answer out. We'd be like, what the F are you talking about? We're taking
right.
anything out.
No.
This is our content.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't decide what. It's like me calling up ESPN and saying, I don't want you guys to re-air this thing. You know, it just wouldn't happen.
I've had to deal with that before.
Yeah, that's where the frustration
is. Or after
was.
The fact, can you take this out? No, sorry, I can't.
Right. Exactly. I mean, it's the principle. Anyway, so those are the two. I mean, I could do a half hour on like different topics, but we're just going to leave it here because, again, I am exhausted. I need a nap. All right, Lou Pellegrino has been the fine producer of this podcast. My thanks to Jim Trotter of ESPN for his time, and please follow him on Twitter and read his stuff. Thanks to everybody at Digital Media and Sports Illustrated for these podcasts. The numbers on this podcast particularly have been growing fantastically. As Lou would say, please subscribe to the podcast, leave comments. The podcast right now is a 5-star rating. I can't thank you guys enough. And this actually has as Lou is nodding his head. Significant impact on where this stuff ranks on the charts and everything else.
Reviews and ratings. Reviews. 5-star ratings and positive reviews.
It moves it up. So if you want this content to continue, please do that. And I thank you, especially if you like it. And I'll continue to get interesting guests like Jim Trotter. Coming up, I know we have Brian Anderson, who's defined Turner Sports baseball and basketball broadcaster, also the voice of the Milwaukee Brewers. Howard Beck of Bleacher Report is coming up in the next couple weeks. Seth Greenberg, the ESPN college basketball announcer. I probably have some other stuff. I just can't think of it off the top.
I'm working on a fun one for you, but we'll keep that hidden.
Yeah, let's keep that hidden. But that could be a really good one, especially if you like pro wrestling. All right. Four.
No code word today, huh?
No code word today.
All right.
God bless code words. All right, listen. For Lou Pellegrino, this is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.